Okay, everyone. Welcome. I will introduce the topic of today and the speaker. And while we do it, we will wait for some more people to join. Let's get started to introduce the speaker today. In today's room, we will be discussing an article authored by Hesam Aklogur.
That's
I
correct.
think
Yeah. Yeah.
I pronounced it correctly. And this article is an RNA-based theory of natural universal computation. And it was recently published in the Journal of Theoretical Biology. So usually this room is a little bit different. It's about more about the study group. Today I decided to invite Hesam because I think his article is very, very extremely, extremely interesting, extremely thought-provoking. And it might also be useful in a bunch of different areas of study. And how it's gonna work, it's as follows. We will start by the Hesam will start by in kind of explaining us a little bit about his article in the first 45 to 60 minutes. I will lead let's say that exposition, and after that time, we will open up for questions in the next 30 minutes, and after that time, that is 1 hour and 15 minutes to 1 hour and a half, we will open up for an after party, and at that time, our speaker is welcome to stay. But if he has to go, he can, because it's been also a long time. So I think it's enough for him to stay just that time. So this is a usual structure that is also followed in other rooms. So I'm just copying it because I think it's pretty cool. And yes, so also this this is going to be the replays are also let's say they are they're it's enabled, so keep it in mind. Just as a small introduction, so my name is Keith Patarroyo. So currently I am a software engineer working in different areas related to biology, computation, the origin of life, and also chemistry. I will introduce today's speaker. His name is Hesam Aklogur. He's currently a postdoc in the Maimon lab at the Rockefeller University. He got his PhD at neuroscience in Princeton, and his undergrad in computer engineering in Sharif University of Technology. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep.
Okay. Today we will be discussing. We'll get started now. We'll be discussing the article, an RNA-based theory of natural computation. So, People are welcome to click on the link in the top, and they will. The PDF is also available, but if it's not the case, I think there's also an archive link that so you can Google it for a preprint version of the article as well. So let's get started. Hassam, it was very, 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 very interesting reading your article. And I think, just to get started, I think if you can explain us a little bit what is the philosophy behind the article, and what I mean about this is perhaps as far as I understand, the idea of the article is to introduce, kind of look for this universal computer in biology that is not, from your opinion, has not been found yet. And perhaps tell us a little bit what was the general idea behind the article.
Sure, yeah. Sorry, there's a little bit of noise. I'm in New York, and I'm going to hope that it's not too annoying for people. Thank you, Keith, for having me. I'm super excited to talk about this stuff. So I guess the general idea behind the paper, the motivation was to try to answer a question that's kind of been on my mind for several years, and it's been inspired by some of Randy Galisto's ideas. Randy Galisto is a professor at Rutgers University, and he's kind of one of the main advocates of a molecular memory theory. So the idea is generally this, that in computer science, we know that there are different scopes of computation. Some computing systems are more powerful than others. And in the 1930s, we figured out that actually there's a limit to the things you can compute. And that limit isn't very hard to achieve. So a lot of different systems that don't really resemble each other, they reach that power of computation. A very popularized example is the Turing machine, Turing machines, because it's not just one machine. Another example that people know less about is lambda calculus. Many of these systems were developed independently. A very frequent thing that happens is people come up with some system that's not intended to be a computation system, and then they realize actually this is as powerful as Turing machines. So one example is Game of Life, Conway's Game of Life. Some people might be familiar with that. So the general idea is, okay, well, we have different scopes of computation, and there's this level of computation power that's not too hard to stumble upon. Why haven't we found anything in biology that achieves that power of computation? And if Randy Galisto's right that computation is actually happening inside neurons, inside brain cells, and it involves molecular machinery, how can you imagine something like that taking place in the cell? But at the same time, we couldn't have discovered it yet. So it can't be something too complicated that would have been obvious if we just look inside the cell. So that's the main motivation. Can you come up with a system, a molecular system, that has that scope of computation, that's able to compute any computable function, but at the same time, it has characteristics that make it hard to have discovered, and we can imagine it have been undiscovered over the years.
Okay, excellent. Excellent introduction. Yes, and I think okay, first of all, I think that was extremely interesting because you addressed the part of the of this memory theory, I think, at the end of your article. So it's interesting now that was one of your main motivations. But before perhaps we delve into that, I want you to explain this kind of misconception that runs around in a lot of circles, that like neural networks are kind of Turing complete, and so you just said like something which is could be heard like a big claim that we haven't really found yet any like Turing complete system inside let's say known processes within biology, because I mean a lot of people may have heard up from neural nets or gene regulatory networks or even chemical well okay I guess with those two are the most perhaps the most popular ones out there. So could you explain maybe a little bit on
Sure.
this side?
So every, I guess, different misconceptions are rooted in different places. So sometimes people refer to something that's called the universal approximation theorem, and they say, okay, well, neural networks can compute anything. Other times they don't refer to that. They refer to these papers that show that recursive neural networks are, in fact, able to simulate Turing machines. Now, every each I guess each one of these roots, I have different things to say about. So, I guess let's start with the second one that I mentioned. There's a paper in the 19 that was published in the 1990s by Sontag and Siegelman. I can't remember the exact year, but I think it was 1998 or something. And that showed that you can actually simulate any Turing machine with neural networks. The problem is that that paper, along with all these other dynamical systems that were put forth in the 90s, none of them have structural stability. So if a dynamical system or a neural network lacks structural stability, that means that you can't even approximate it. You can't build it, and you can't even find it to occur in nature. And we can go to reasons why that's the case. The other thing that people bring up a lot, that I hear people bring up, is the universal approximation theorem, that claims that neural networks, feed-forward neural networks, actually can approximate any function. Now, the problem with that statement is we're ignoring conditions that are placed on those functions. The kind of functions that feed-forward neural networks are able to approximate are bounded functions and continuous. They have to be bounded and continuous. They have to have these two conditions, and this kind of limits the kind of things that we can compute to very severe degrees. So you can't compute a lot of things that we're interested in computer science, for example. Like, you can't, I don't know, use feed-forward neural networks to determine if a number is a prime number.
So I think that's a big misconception running around in a lot of places, I think, especially inside machine learning circles, that people believe that neural nets are somehow Turing complete. But yeah, also another thing you mentioned, which is very, very interesting, and that is also perhaps ignored, is the idea of memory expansion and the fact. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah. So I mentioned that the people accidentally stumble upon universal computation, and one example that I mentioned was Game of Life, Conway's Game of Life, but there are other examples like Wang Tao's or Wolfram's Rule 110, which is like a linear cellular automata. These are systems that kind of people came up with just because they were interesting mathematically, and then later on, they were proven to be able to simulate Turing machines, and that means that they can be used to compute any computable function, including things like, I don't know, is this number a prime number? So how does this happen? Like, on the one hand, it looks like people are accidentally stumbling upon it, so it shouldn't be too hard to achieve. But on the other hand, we haven't even come up with a model in biology. And I think the thing that's lacking in our models, that exists in all of the models that accidentally did stumble upon universal computation, is what I call memory expansion. In a system where memory capacity can be defined, let's say, I don't know, in, I can say a computer program, when I run a computer program, it uses, I don't know, 100 megabytes of memory, and then it terminates. That's a system where memory usage can be defined. In a system where memory usage can be defined, a necessary condition to be able to achieve universal computation is that memory usage is not predetermined before seeing the input. So in all these systems, like let's say in Conway's Game of Life, you can have a pattern and that pattern can progress over time and, I don't know, grow and change shape or form or whatever. And you can define its memory usage to be the amount of space that it occupies in this two-dimensional infinite world or whatever. What a program can do in that world is it can expand in the surrounding space. I guess processes that are like this, processes that can recruit memory over time, have already kind of achieved that one important ingredient, which is memory expansion. Once you have that, as long as the rules are, you know, just a little bit complex, not ridiculously simple, then you're very likely to come up with a universal computation system.
Yes. Yeah. So I think this is a key point, I believe. So correct me. Maybe I'll just rephrase what you just said, because I believe it's very, very important in what I believe your line of logic is, and is the idea that if we found like this kind of accidental Turing complete systems. But for example, there is a very interesting website that is called like accidentally Turing complete. And that's not only related with some of the systems that you mentioned, but for example, like Microsoft PowerPoint is like accidentally Turing complete, which is
crazy. Pretty cool. What's the website? I haven't seen this.
Yes, it's called like accidentally Turing complete, and there are a bunch of like software. Let me look it up, and I'll send it to you. But and there is like I think people love to find these things. Of course, Microsoft Excel is also accidentally Turing complete, and. And a bunch of other software, also video games. So this is kind of people didn't intend any of these systems to be Turing complete.
And yeah, I think Minecraft is also
exactly
Turing complete.
Yes, exactly. So people love to like build computers out of these systems. And the point that I think you're raising is that, okay, so if we found this like accidentally, I mean, very likely nature, even in very simple systems as well, may have also found it accidentally. And so it is maybe very strange that that nature just happen not to use kind of a Turing complete system if we have been using it in like maybe since the 1950s, like it's basically now in absolutely everything. Now I think there is even clothing with microprocessors, so it's strange that this is not the case. That's what I wanted to say. Now, perhaps what we should go on, where we should continue is perhaps maybe you can tell us a bit about some of the history of like RNA computation, but perhaps not necessarily as a natural, trying to find it in the natural world, but rather in the laboratory.
Yeah. So these are all good points that you're raising about how we're actually using in technology, using universal computation and technology and everything. We can talk more about that. But to I guess follow up with what you asked right now, so there is a very rich history of DNA and RNA-based computation. And I believe it started from Charles Bennett. If I'm saying his name right, I think his first name is Charles, but his last name is Bennett. He was working at IBM at the time, and he kind of put forth this idea that you can have DNA-based computers. And I think the way that he conceived of it was that a polymer or like a DNA strand or something can be used as a Turing machine tape. And then from that, I guess then a bunch of different models kind of arise. Not all of these models were Turing complete. So, as far as I can tell, the models that, let's say, solve the travel salesman problem using DNA computation, even though travel salesman problem is a challenging task, it's an NP-hard task or NP-complete task, I think. That model that was able to solve travel salesman problem was not universal, or at least they didn't make that claim or prove it or anything. But there have been a bunch of like a I don't know maybe. More than a dozen different models that are universal and DNA based or RNA based. Now these models are kind of they're a little too complex to have already occurred in nature. Like we can't imagine any of those models already functioning in cells. Why? Because some of them have things like growing crystals. Like if you want to carry out a computation, you're going to have some kind of a tile of DNA is just like growing, and that would be something that you would definitely see inside a cell if it's happening. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Yes, and in fact, I also believe that one of the externalities, perhaps, of the model that you will talk about in a couple of minutes, is that perhaps it will be useful as well in like DNA computing, or at least it will be an alternative to some of the things that have been proposed.
Yeah, I hope
And
so. Yeah.
moreover, since, as you just said, they are kind of complicated, the current ones. So maybe as you will explain it in a minute, your model really is kind of so easy to implement that it only uses kind of two operations. So we will talk about that briefly, but I think as kind of a last point of introduction here, I want you to perhaps just talk about a little bit about this big problem currently in genetics that is the problem of like non-coding RNA or the so-called junk RNA. That, I mean, it's very controversial, I think, within the field. But like for example, some people like I think Matic in Australia have been kind of pushing for perhaps interpreting this kind of non-coding RNA in a different way.
Yeah, actually, that's a really interesting topic. In 2020, when I was like sitting down and trying to like I don't know write this paper up because we couldn't go to lab or anything, I started diving into the literature about non-coding RNA, and I encountered what I think is the most heated debate that I've seen, at least in the scientific literature. It's like a pretty fierce, like I guess the attacks and stuff that I would see that like are very openly published in the literature. So there was this debate over the past 10 years about the functionality of the non-protein coding part of the genome. So DNA encodes for proteins, and that's the I guess, the main role that we ascribe to DNA and RNA. We think of them as systems that encode the amino acid sequences through nucleotide sequences. So every triplet of nucleotides corresponds to a single amino acid, and these strings of amino acids are proteins, are what constitute proteins. And that's the main role that we think DNA have. Now, at the same time, we discovered that less than 2% of our DNA, and of the human DNA, ends up in messenger RNA. And most of that, about half of that, is non-coding sequences. So less than 1% of our genome is encoding for protein sequences. And so, you know, how do people, explain this? And usually the typical explanation is that it's all junk. It's all junk DNA. Well, not all of it. Like, recently people have kind of been backing down on that claim, and you know, they're saying, okay, maybe some of it's a regulatory. But I guess right now the debate is, on one side of the spectrum, people are saying that maybe, like, I don't know, 8% of our genome is functional, and on the other side, people are saying, we don't know. It could be that most, if not close to all, of our DNA is functional. And yeah, so this is a very heated debate. First, people found that those regions that are non-protein coding are being transcribed abundantly, and this was met with controversy at first, and now I guess it's kind of well accepted that they're pervasively transcribed. The transcribed means turned into RNA, but still the functionality of these RNA are disputed and being debated right now. So this paper, I guess, it also kind of addresses that question as well. It just happens so that RNA is really well suited for computation, and maybe this is what that non-protein coding function of the genome is doing right now.
Yes, that's a super interesting topic, I think. For example, in order to prepare to this presentation today, I asked one friend of mine who is a geneticist to kind of tell me what is the current consensus in the literature about non-coding RNA. And he mentioned that recently it's been kind of proposed that is, like, used in a bunch of and I think you mentioned it also in your article, for morphogenesis and for other different biological processes. But I think it's still a big question and I was aware of this problem before, now I think one of the ideas that you're proposing is that in fact it's being used for computation. So I think that's really interesting. Now I think we finished kind of with the main pieces to try to put the idea that you recently proposed together, and so perhaps the final piece, I guess, is kind of the idea of combinators, and perhaps you can explain us what is a combinator and why perhaps people didn't think that it was being used in biology.
Yeah, that's a great question. So before I answer this question, I just want to mention that Daniel, which is down in the audience, he knows way more than me about non-coding RNA, might be able to say some interesting stuff about that. But yeah, so combinatory logic was this mathematical system that was developed in the early 20th century. And that system is also powerful enough to compute any computable function. It's actually the first system that humans came up with that's able to compute any computable function. But at the time that people came up with it, they didn't know it had this really interesting property. And it was developed independently twice, at least, by Haskell Curry and Moses Schoenfinkel. Now, for reasons that I don't quite understand, it's kind of been neglected, even in computer science and even in math. Like, I don't think it's a very active area of research. I did computer science in undergrad, and they didn't teach me anything about lambda calculus or combinatorial logic. Both of these systems are equivalent, combinatorial logic and lambda calculus. And so yeah, it's kind of like been in the sidelines, and so it's not that surprising that people haven't really been trying to explore how it could map onto any biological processes. Now, I think it's a very beautiful system. Like, once I started learning about it, playing around with combinators and stuff, it's very enjoyable. Like, I think anyone with the slightest degree of interest in math would enjoy playing around with these entities that are called combinators and trying to figure out what they can compute and what kind of combinators can you build with other combinators. And there's actually a very interesting book by Raymond Smullyan, and it's called To Mock a Mockingbird, and he kind of walks through a bunch of puzzles that he came up with about these combinators. But yeah, so combinatorial logic is actually a alternative foundation for mathematics. It's an alternative to set theory. So the same way that set theory can be used to build everything in math, from, I don't know, numbers, real numbers, integers, whatever, you can also, instead of using sets, you can use combinators. And just to briefly mention what they are, they're functions. They're functions that take functions and output functions. So everything's a function. Everything's a combinator. An example, a very simple example of a combinator is the identity combinator. It returns whatever it's given. So if you give a combinator to I, the identity combinator, it returns that.
Yes, thank you for the explanation. It's super interesting. To be honest, what really made me kind of do this room was the fact that you use combinators, really, because I've been really thinking about combinators for maybe the past months, and I think it's amazing how you manage to use them to, and also we will discuss kind of the problem of parentheses in a minute, but also I think it's really remarkable how you were able to use combinators and solve the problem of parentheses. I think I found that extremely elegant, and so elegant that in fact I believe might be implemented in DNA, sorry, in RNA. I mean, we will talk about those details in a minute. I just wanted to mention that definitely combinators are not the most popular, let's say, computational model that is out there. But I think a lot of people are trying to use them today in chemistry. Well, not a lot of people. Some people are trying to use them in chemistry, and your model of RNA computation is also, I think, I believe, an extremely interesting addition to the work being done in combinators. And just as perhaps as a small factoid, so this Silicon Valley company is called Y Combinator, which is the supposed like hotbed for startups. So they also like combinators a lot, and some people have studied combinators in theoretical computer science, but as you mentioned, it's been really kind of a very small community. And to be quite honest, it's hard to before actually reading your paper, to me it was kind of hard to visualize how could one implement this in some sort of real world application. But I think you kind of solved that very beautifully. And in that regard, perhaps comes my next questions, which is the fact of the parentheses problem that combinators have. And it's a super interesting problem because there is this kind of theorem inside kind of, let's say, Chomsky, kind of Chomsky grammars that says that there is like a kind of a exponential explosion of if you ever try to remove kind of this problem of parentheses in kind of this one dimensional symbolic language, but you manage to solve this problem in kind of in with DNA, or you manage to discover perhaps how RNA how nature is perhaps solving this problem in a two-dimensional way. So perhaps you can talk about this.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I did anything remarkable. It's just noticing a very obvious thing that's I guess a parallel between what happens with RNA molecules and what is needed in combinatory logic. So in combinatory logic, you need parentheses. Terms are parenthesized. Like you can compose a combinator out of other combinators, and then that's a new combinator that you can feed into another combinator and stuff like that. And at the same time, well, so if you want to implement this molecularly, then you have this challenge. Like, how do you implement parentheses? If you want to implement parentheses with symbols, like if you want to, I don't know, say open parenthesis is these two nucleotides and closed is these two nucleotides, then you have to match parentheses. You have to figure out, okay, what's the matching parenthesis, closed parenthesis to this open parenthesis? And that's a hard problem. That needs something like a stack or a machine that processes along that RNA and counts how many parentheses you've seen so far. However, RNA elegantly solves this problem. It's kind of obvious. Like if you know RNA biology and you know combinatory logic, it's pretty easy to notice this parallel between them. So I guess I didn't do much except for just know about both of these things and notice this similarity. In fact, I was convinced that someone else had brought this up in the literature. Like I just knew that I had to go and find some paper that's already brought up this similarity, but I guess no one had until now, mostly because combinatory logic had been neglected. Yeah, so just to give an idea of the concept is the same way that you can get double helices with DNA, you can get duplexes with RNA. And an RNA strand can bring in two parts of itself. So two different segments of the same strand can come together and twist into this helix that we call RNA duplexes or stems. And that can be interpreted as a parenthesis. And that makes everything so much easier if you're trying to implement something like combinatory logic.
Yes, definitely. So I welcome people to Google just RNA stem loops, and they will realize that if one interprets perhaps the parentheses as just when the RNA strand starts kind of becoming it becomes with, like it binds with another. It pairs with another. One kind of quickly see that this is kind of a really kind of interesting solution to the parentheses problem, because kind of in a graphical way, one can notice that when the parenthesis is open and when the parenthesis is closed. In fact, this problem of parentheses in Chomsky grammars is solved precisely that way. One has to generate a graphical notation in order to solve this parenthesis problem. In fact, if you for example notice, like in physics or in mathematics, the notation of the tensor notation, and one wants to kind of try to implement this notation in just a one-dimensional alphabet, is not going to be possible, because there will be an exponential explosion. So this is, for example, the beginning. The origin of, for example, Penrose notation for tensors. So in the same way, if one has like a sort of a protein or a language, one has to generate a two-dimensional graphical language to represent this. And it's very interesting that you found out that nature does this in, or you already implemented, or perhaps it already implemented this kind of exponential problem using kind of RNA stem loops. So I find that extremely interesting. So now we can follow in a bunch of different directions, but since we are trying just to kind of go over the concepts here, perhaps I want to follow a kind of perhaps if you can kind of tell us a little bit about what this kind of addressable memory is all about, because I think perhaps people that are already familiar with combinators and maybe kind of get the idea, but I think one of your additional contributions is the fact that you are able to implement all the combinator operations just using two operations, which is cleavages and
ligation. Cleavage just means cutting an RNA, and ligation means connecting two ends of RNA strands together. I guess the terminology is also used for DNA as well, but yeah, you get the point. Cleavage is cutting, ligation is connecting. And these are two operations that we know happen all the time in cells. As you mentioned, there's like one additional thing that I added to the models that made them slightly deviate from combinatory logic. And that's that I allowed it for variables. I put in the ability to define a variable and reference that variable. This is strictly not allowed in combinatory logic or lambda calculus. You can't have unbounded I think it's called unbound variables. Everything has to be bounded in lambda calculus. So what this does is you can have an RNA strand be referenced by another strand. So if one RNA strand is supposed to be, I don't know, computing something, I don't know, the result of some computation, some function or something, the result of that computation can be integrated into another RNA and then used for further computation. And this is important because, first of all, it gives it allows for cohesion in the cell. It provides a shared memory space where all the RNAs can interact with one another. But also, it allows us to eliminate one of the combinators that makes life very hard, or it makes it really hard to imagine implementing something like this inside a cell, and that's the duplicating combinators. So they're called M or W, or the combinators have bird names. So it's an idea that Raymond Smullyan came up with and people stick to, the mockingbird or the warbler. These two birds are duplicating combinators, and because we don't know of any system that's able to replicate RNA from RNA templates that exists across, you know, all organisms, that's kind of a thorn in the model. So you can eliminate that if you allow for variables and addressing and referencing. And then once you have that, then another thing in biology comes into play into this model, which is transcription, building RNA strands off of DNA. And that we already know to happen, but it just makes the model able to circumvent the need for having duplicating combinators. Does that make sense? Maybe I tried to not go into too much detail, and maybe that just made it more confusing. I can expand or elaborate on any of the points that I just made.
Okay, so maybe we can expand in a couple of things, because I mean, if people are looking at the paper right now, maybe they can take a look at figure number six. But otherwise, perhaps what something that you mentioned is that these memory addresses kind of can refer to themselves, right? And yes. This is something that I found quite interesting about your model, and is the fact that that there is self-reference in this model, which is something that, I mean, usually people don't want in their computational models, because self-reference becomes very difficult, especially to, I mean, programs with self-reference become extremely difficult, right, to debug. So I wonder first whether this self-reference I know that this self-reference is making you able to kind of avoid this copy operation. But at the same time, I wonder if you worry that this self-referential, let's say, aspect of the theory is going to like make it kind of maybe ill-defined or some sort of in that way.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it actually makes it easier to understand or debug. So if I were to write a programming language that would use combinatory logic, I would actually want to avoid the mockingbird or the warbler, and instead put the ability to use self-referencing. Because even like when we're trying to construct programs in combinatory logic, first we make a self-referencing term, that is, define X in terms of X. So I don't know, like if you want to build a program that computes factorial, you can define it recursively and say, okay, the factorial of n equals n times the factorial of n minus 1. And in combinatory logic terms, that would be defining x in terms of x. That's not allowed. So after you do that, you do a few operations and you take x to the rightmost side or whatever. And then you use this combinator, which you referred to earlier, which is called the Y combinator. And there's like this company named after it that you mentioned. But that then allows you to define X in terms of basic combinators, not in terms of itself, and also achieve that same function that you want. So we already go through this step when we're trying to program with combinatory logic. It doesn't make it any more contradictory in terms of like the self-consistency of the system, because Yes, you can have ill-defined terms with self-referencing, but you can also have ill-defined terms with pure combinatory logic. And this is something they realized later on, the people who invented it. They avoided self-referencing because they didn't want contradictions in their system. And then they realized that actually it's no different than any of the other systems, and you can end up with terms that are ill-defined.
Okay, excellent answer. So I will ask three last questions, and I think we will go next to questions from the audience. So first, I want you to perhaps comment a bit on this computational model, perhaps I want you to tell us some of the misconceptions of the combinators, and that people think that they are slow, or also that you cannot do like parallel computation. If one looks at this one dimensional line of combinators, one may think, oh, this is super slow. How can nature be doing this?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I love your questions. There's actually a bad reputation for combinators for just being slow at doing things like math or addition or whatever. And this is a result of the numerical systems that people built with combinators are unary systems. So like if you want to represent one, it's like some symbol, and if you want to represent two, it's two of those symbols, and then three is three of those symbols next to each other. And then for things like addition or multiplication, the number of operations that you need to execute that computation is on the order of the answer. So if you're multiplying 100 by 100, you need 10,000 operations on the order of 10,000 operations, n squared operations for doing calculating the square of a number, which is, you know, it's not very useful. Even if you build something like that, it's not very useful to use in computation. However, that's just because the people that came up with these systems weren't really thinking about algorithmic complexity or trying to optimize it in terms of its algorithmic efficiency, either in memory or a number of operations. But it's super easy to come up with numerical systems that are based on binary schemes of representation or even decimal schemes of representation. And with those systems, compute addition, multiplication, or any arithmetic operation you want with the same algorithmic complexity that we do on our computers. So there's really no limitation in terms of, efficiency or algorithmic efficiency when it comes to combinatory logic. In fact, you alluded to the possibility of doing parallel computations with combinatory logic. There's this theorem in combinatory logic called the Church-Rosser theorem that says that if there's multiple places in the string that you can edit, it really doesn't matter which one you do first. So you can do the editing operations in any order, and the end result will be the same. And that's just another magical property that's just another one of those stars aligning in this theory that says that, okay, well, if like you have an RNA strand and based on the rules, there's more than one spot that can be edited, these molecules, they can't have, I don't know, some overseer that's deciding, okay, let's do this one first and let's do the other one first. So if it was sensitive to the order of these operations, that would be, you know, another disadvantage of having a computation system based on RNA combinatory logic. But fortunately, that doesn't happen, and because of Church-Rosser theorem. So you can edit things in parallel, and you can parallelize an algorithm to an arbitrary degree. So in our computers, we can also do parallel algorithms or parallel computations, but we are limited by the number of CPU cores, which is usually just a handful. So scaling the number of parallel streams of computation isn't super easy with the architectures that we have in our computers. But if you're using something based on combinatory logic, where there's no like central processing unit that's like I don't know 5 or 6 central processing units that are doing these operations. The operations are carried out by just enzymes floating around and noticing these patterns that can be edited. It looks like there's much more potential for parallel computation in a system that's based on combinatory logic implemented through RNA or whatever whatever system that you can think of.
Yeah. Actually, when you mentioned the Church-Russell theorem, I was reminded of a bunch of things that's been done in like parallel computation and different parallel architectures and in distributed computation too. So that was interesting too. And I think people have talked about this on that regard, but what is perhaps more interesting is the fact that kind of these operations that you mentioned in the article can be performed on parallel, which is I think quite remarkable. So to end, I'll just finish with two questions regarding perhaps coming all the way to the beginning, asking you, so how is your theory perhaps complementing kind of the hypothesis that you wanted to work on about this idea of that like inside neurons or inside cells there is computation being done, and perhaps you can talk a little bit more about it.
Yeah, I guess that's an area that would be a little bit more speculatory, but there are different domains where an RNA computation system can be maybe used, and these domains include things like embryonic development, single cell behavior, homeostasis, or even cognition. And the way that it can be involved in cognition is, I guess, not really clear to me yet. Because I mean, even this theory is just an idea whose details need to be fleshed out in experiments. But as I mentioned earlier, one of the motivations for thinking about this problem was Randy Galistel's idea that memories are encoded in information bearing molecules. And that the way that these memories are read out, converted to neural activity is not really clear to me. But it's not an impossible area that we can discover things that we might not be thinking about today.
Yeah. Exactly. Interesting. Yeah, and of course this is. Yeah, this was more of a speculative question, but I just wanted to perhaps try to tie it all the way to what you mentioned us in the beginning, and just perhaps as a last question, and we can open up to the people in the audience, is about the non-coding DNA. I'm very curious how perhaps. Your theory is, or how can it contribute to this kind of big debate inside genetics, or what should we perhaps experimentally discover to perhaps settle this debate inside genetics?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There's people who are actively working on this and trying to push the needle on the debate of non-protein coding RNA function. I guess one of the falsifiable predictions of this idea that non-protein coding DNA and RNA are critically functional is that if you replace those sequences with gibberish, or if you, I don't know, take them out or kind of shuffle them around, do things like that, then you won't see a big effect or a detrimental effect in, I don't know, whether it's development or cognition or whatever domain that you think that the non-coding RNA is involved. But, you know, those experiments are not trivial to do. There's also, you know, other paths that one can take, like, I don't know, if you sequence the transcriptome and see some kinds of editing, some indications of editing rules that are normally thrown out with our current analysis methods. That might be a path towards figuring or settling that debate or figuring out what kind of editing rules underlie computation. Again, Daniel, which is in the audience, I know has some thoughts about this, so he might be able to add to that.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Hassan, for these.
Sure. Thank you. These were really, really interesting questions and cool questions. I really enjoyed them.
Yeah. So let's kind of reset the room and now we will go through to our next stage. It will be questions from the audience. So people are welcome to ask questions about perhaps some of Hassan research, or perhaps about the article, or like open questions in general. And yeah, so after this, it will be maybe 30 minutes of questions. And after these 30 minutes of questions, we will go and have an after party, and people can stay for 30 minutes more. And Hassan is welcome to stay for as long as he wants after these 30 minutes of questions. But yeah, so I think I have someone here. Yeah, so hello. So Heil.
Hi, hello. Hi, thanks for the interesting concept, and thanks, Hassan. That was very interesting. I tried to ping a few people that might have been interested, but I found out that there was another room somewhere. Like there's a room that's regularly run by Paul Boril, something like that. And I suppose if that room wasn't there, probably more people would have joined here. So I suggest that maybe it would be good if we do this again. You do this again, like in another time in future. Yeah, and maybe if a few people who listen to this, if people listen to this, but maybe I'm sure there are more people who are there are many more people who are interested. So first, thanks for that, and then but yeah. I don't know, we don't, because on the other time also this might happen, so it's a bit of luck involved as well. So I have a question as well, two questions actually. So I ask one of them first. So it's a bit off topic, but in general, because I see you have been contemplating and reading about and you have some opinions about RNA as computation and DNA as computation, etc. So, if you consider a similar problem of if we look at the genome of, for example, a new virus that will come in future, right now we cannot make sense of if you have a full complete genome. Right now we cannot probably understand what those what computations are done by that genome. Well, first of all, let's assume that most of the things that the genome does can be described in terms of computation and plus a few other things like protein synthesis and stuff like that. So knowing this, the combinators and the other concepts that you mentioned, if we know them well and if we have enough data, how far are we from understanding this problem, specific problem, that if we look at the genome, we can make sense of how this, for example, virus or this mechanism works? By how far we are from that, I mean is there a lot more to be understood, and is it achievable in, for example, our lifetimes, and is it achievable in general or not? Imagine a system that kind of automatic system or a bunch of research studies that can reverse engineer a genome. How much do you think that would be possible?
Yeah, that's a very intriguing question. So I think the main challenge for getting there, if that's a place that we can get to, is finding the rules or the combinators or whatever system it's based on for the computation system. But even if that exists and we find it, it's not trivial to figure out what a code does. So we have this in computer science as well. Like if I give you a compiled code, a code that's basically an assembly language, it's not easy to figure out what that code does without, I guess, seeing the source code or something. And that same challenge could exist with interpreting a combinatory logic term. So, but it's not impossible. Like if you put enough people on an assembly code, you know, I think they'll be able to figure out what's happening. I mean, depending on how complex that code is. So, to get to your question, like if there's, I don't know, if you're trying to figure out what a virus does or some pathogen or something that's RNA based or DNA based, the method of action is, that's the second challenge of trying to figure out what it does just from seeing the code. But whether we can see, I mean, I think the main challenge right now and the thing I'm mostly focused on is trying to figure out what the editing rules are, what the computation system is, if there is one. And if we can get that in my lifetime, I'm satisfied, you know. I'll let that the next steps for the next generation.
Yeah, that's interesting. Even if the source code is available and not just assembly code, it can be hard or difficult to understand because sometimes you have an unrefactored code, it's very difficult. But just to have that code that at a level like assembly, for example. So my question was more about how far we are from there. Or let's say say it in a different way. If we consider these combinators and other operators and other building blocks that you mentioned, how are these close to be all of the building blocks, or are there more building blocks that needs to be discovered? What do you think?
So you can achieve universal computation with just a few combinators. You can even do it with one combinator. But that combinator needs more than one rule for
we can do universal computation, but my question is more how much if you want to reverse engineer, if you know some of the operators that we know well how to compute with them, it would be not enough to understand how it does. So I'm saying this may be enough for universal computation, but the universal computation that the organism does, maybe does a few other essential ones.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I don't know that if it has redundant combinators, if the system is using, you know, another, I don't know, like more combinators than it needs, or more editing rules than it needs to achieve universal computation, then you know, you have to, I guess you have to discover those. But, you know, it's a little, I feel like it intuitively, it's less plausible. That situation is less plausible. And the reason for that, if I can give you like an example that would explain my intuition, we have come up with a set of CPU operations that hasn't really changed over like many decades. I'm talking about like CPU operations on our computer. I don't know, there's like add or multiply or whatever, you know, there's a bunch. And then we're using that, still using that to do all sorts of computations, even if you want to, I don't know, like run some deep learning algorithm, you're still using it. Although you're using GPUs, which are optimized for other things. But my point is, once you have a set of basic operations that take you there, it's hard to imagine why another one would evolve. Unless it's really essential for optimization. I don't know. I have to think about that a bit. But in short, my intuition is that the system would just have a set of sufficient combinators and it would stick to that.
Thank you. That was an interesting argument. I have another question, but I'll ask later.
Thank you. Yeah.
So are you there, Mohammed?
Yeah, I'm there. So thank you, Keith, for organizing, and thank you, Hassan, for the wonderful presentation of your paper. I saw it some time ago, and actually this was a trigger for me to look again at combinators. As you mentioned, they were invented by Moses Schoenfinkel when he was doing his habilitation thesis with David Hilbert in Göttingen. It's, as also you mentioned, no one knows why this was abundant for such a long time. You mentioned that they are equivalent to lambda calculus. And actually, there is also a representation of them using lambda calculus, if I still have the details in my head. My question is, I have two questions. Maybe the first one is, somehow you need hardware and a software. And in what you said, I wasn't able really to distinguish where is the program stored, and it's probably the RNA is somehow, or the operations on the RNA are somehow the hardware, but I couldn't really distinguish between where is the software stored and where is exactly the hardware. So this would be the first question.
I might need you to elaborate on that, because let me just give you a two sentence explanation, and maybe this will solve it. Otherwise, elaborate on your question. The combinators are represented as RNA strands. So every RNA strand corresponds to a combinator term. It's not exactly that, because it could have references, which are strictly speaking not really can be directly mapped to a combinator. But loosely speaking, yes, every combinator is mapped to a strand. I guess that's also the hardware, because that's what's storing the information for it. So the sequence of nucleotides might be the software. I don't know. I guess it's hard to map that dichotomy of hardware and software, or categorization of hardware and software to this theory.
Yeah.
Yes. Go ahead, Keith.
No, what I wanted to say is that was another thing that really impressed me, I think, about this theory of Hassan, is that it's precisely not like, how can I say, the software and the hardware are kind of coupled together. And I think that's most likely the like something that probably arised in nature, because just for example, this is another question that I had for Hassan, but I will ask it if I can later. But I don't think it's kind of easy to grasp this difference. But go ahead, Mohammed.
Yeah, because you also mentioned the Church-Russell theorem. So this is for me something. So you also said that it's actually independent which order of operations you're doing. You end up having the same result at the end. So it looks for me like confluence. That, but usually when you start with some rules, these rules are not confluent. You have to complete them to reach a confluent system. And Church-Russell is, if I remember correctly, some sort of criterion that tells you, if you can check this and this, then you have already achieved a confluent system where it's really regardless which path you go. But somehow I would still in my mind search for a completion system or a complete system where we know that the Church-Russell criterion applies and somehow a kind of direction for the program. So what is this program or software, even if it's merged with the hardware, trying to compute? So where's the goal?
So I think you might be able to correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I think if you build it, if your primitive combinators are proper combinators, that is, they can be built by, you know, the standard combinators that we use, I don't know, S and K or something, then I think Church-Russell theorem holds. So regardless of which combinators are your primitive combinators, I think the Church-Russell theorem holds. Maybe you might have thoughts on that. Regarding the second question, like, what's the goal? I guess I'm not sure what that means exactly, because you can have asked the same question for computer programs. Like, we use computer programs for computing things we're interested in. And you know, every function is independently trying to find the answer to some mapping, and we compose those to, you know, have an application called Clubhouse where we talk to each other, or you know, all the other things that we do with computers. It's not really like I don't know, maybe I didn't completely understand your question.
It's probably related again to my first question, because I cannot really get it out of my head. Where can we find out what is getting computed? Maybe this is also even connected to Sohail's question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's confusing, right? Because, you know, one of the things about RNA is it can be just a sequence where it's storing information in the codons and the nucleotides. So that would be, you know, the direct mRNA is more like that when it's being synthesized from its compatible DNA sequence, right? It's kind of just a long strain. And it doesn't also have these protein-like behaviors. But messenger RNA, I mean, a transfer RNA actually does. It folds up, and then it's able to attach to amino acids, right, and bring those together. So that has more of a folding shape that is more, you know, doing a process as well. And then you also have like ribosomal DNA, you know, which is, I'm sorry, ribosomal RNA, which again, those strands, depending on their sequence, can kind of fold up into protein-like structures and carry out kinds of enzymatic activities in some case. And like you actually see it in terms of, you know, mRNA, tRNA, and ribosomal RNA. So some are more, you know, protein-like behaviors and doing the machinery of processing. But, you know, you could see, in fact, in some ways, one type of RNA is acting on the other, where the mRNA is more like just straight line information encoding amongst the sequence of codons. but then the other types of RNA are doing something a little more like along the lines of processing. But the category can be mixed up, right? That's kind of the power of, it's sloppy too.
Yeah, that does
I don't know
that
if that clarifies anything.
Yeah.
Yeah,
This
okay.
goes
Yeah.
in a good
And one could even
direction.
also, you could also add the same thing with proteins themselves, right? Because there is an aperiodic, there could be some kind of codons in the sequence of the amino acids. I mean, originally that was when they were trying to figure out what was what in the cell. Some people thought the hereditary molecule might be proteins because again, you've got there's a good place, a string of amino acids. There's 22 of them, but instead of four, but one could see the possibility of there being that as being the hereditary information carrying molecule. And again, you would still have the same thing. It's folding up much more than RNA, so it's making all these different bumpy and active sites that do all the processing of the cell's work. But again, the information is there as well. So and it might maybe that's yet another Hassan, another place where you might find these Y combinators. And again, the evolution is sloppy, so one shouldn't expect that the most precise and essential components will exist. But they could that they could exist. They can more likely they're going to be kludgy and messy. Maybe after another 100 million years of evolution, they'll be more precise and pared down, necessary and sufficient only.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, thank you, Ethan. I guess with Ethan's answer, I now I understood your question. Yeah, so there could
Does that
be
make sense,
many
Mohammed?
different.
Yeah, sorry. I just want to make sure.
Yeah.
A lot. Thank you both very much.
Yeah. So as Ethan mentioned, RNA can be enzymatic itself. It can cause reactions. There are elements inside RNA strands that we call ribozymes. They can do stuff. They can even, I guess, even like do things like detect temperature or detect the presence of certain chemicals, and then based on that, regulate translation of mRNA to certain proteins and things like that. But right now, the end product of this entire RNA system is thought to be mostly protein synthesis. So the output of the system at the end, there's like a bottleneck, and it has to go through synthesizing proteins. That's how it can have an effect on the cell function. But I don't think that's necessarily something we should limit ourselves to. Like maybe there are some other effects that RNA strands can have that don't necessarily go through the route of protein synthesis. And we should be open-minded about that.
Okay, thank you, Mohammed. Ethan, do you have any question?
No, just I was going to add maybe I don't need to confuse, but there's even more to be added in terms of like, and this gets to like abiogenesis, like which came first, protein, RNA. Seems actually like DNA came last, perhaps, because the RNA has proteins might have found a way to make RNA at some point and then transferred some of the information carrying capacity to them. And then further backed into DNA as being a more stable but less direct, machine part of it. So I mean, it's confusing as it is right now, but there's other lines of reasoning to suggest that. I don't want to get too off topic, but it just shows that there's different, all these different molecules. Those three molecules all have the ability to kind of, to more or less of an extent, do both functions. DNA would seem to have the least ability to have like enzymatic activity, but the most to have just a straight, information sequence, whereas RNA has a little bit of both. And then proteins might have the most function, but the hardest time maybe preserving just something as a sequence for storing information.
I think one interesting aspect that I'm trying to figure out if more and more people are have been looking into is sort of like the membrane voltage of the cells itself. Because that's one thing with RNA that's very different from DNA is single-stranded nucleic acids are extremely negatively charged because of the phosphate backbone. So one thing that definitely changes as you're changing secondary structures of the same molecule is the negative charge of the molecule in itself. But most things with like when it comes down to like how the cell maintains like homeostasis of its membrane voltage is always focused on ions and channels and those kind of things. And like, I never really seen anyone just looking at the basics of like how all these single-stranded RNA are actually contributing to the membrane voltage. But I'm not like a physicist, so I'm have a hard time knowing if it's even like relevant on the scale, or if it just like will have no impact whatsoever on the overall cell, because the ionic effects are just so much bigger.
Yeah, that's a good point. But wouldn't it have to be something that interacts with RNA at the membrane to affect the
So that's one thing I've been thinking about. Like, maybe we're looking for RNAs. You definitely have a lot of RNAs that get localized to the membrane, and there are ways in which like the secondary structure can contribute how things are getting localized to the membrane. But I've never seen anyone doing an investigation of what is happening if you localize a bunch of RNAs to the membrane that have a particular charge or anything like that, or if it's like not in the bounds of what we can do experimentally currently, or someone that just haven't thought about it.
Yeah, that's a really cool idea. Yeah,
like do we know anyone who's like a physicist who knows more about the membrane voltage against like, because my feeling is like probably no one has been looking into this, because like when you run the numbers, it just doesn't make sense. It's just at a so low scale, so it's not going to have any impact. And then I think like the book should be closed on that thing. But it is an interesting properties with single-stranded nucleic acids that they are extremely negatively charged.
Can I follow up on this? Because I kind of want to probe to see if we can, like, I don't know, get an approximate answer. So with nanopore sequencing, we're essentially doing that, right? Like it's a nanopore sequencing is a technology that we came up with. But what it does is it passes the RNA strand through the membrane, and the physics are enough to actually extract a signal out of it just from the membrane potential. Is that right?
Yeah, 100%. That's essentially how nanopore works. Exactly. You're measuring the membrane potential across acid modes.
Technically, it's not inconceivable. Like, it's not like the physics just don't work out. Like, you could imagine, I don't know, some process that's not necessarily exactly like that, but you know, something that affects the cell membrane potential by I don't know, passing through an RNA or something like that.
Yeah, so that's one thing I've been thinking about. But like, I've never. I think what I'm looking for is a physicist that could like. Just like tell me if this is even like fruitful to go in for the biology for it, because I think that probably would be like a really fruitful avenue. Because one could imagine this being the scenario, that it's very unknown how the cell can maintain its membrane potential. Like different neurons in the brain, or like even just like heart cells or whatever, they have an identity when it comes to the membrane potential they should hold. And for a really long time, it was thought that this was very simple and just had to do with calcium. And calcium was a master regulatory that would then control transcription. So the transcription is controlled by calcium, and then transcription of these RNAs then controls how much proteins of these ion channels you get in the membrane. And that's the end of the story. So even if you would like disrupt the cell somehow, like the protein synthesis and stuff like that, the cell will still remember what sort of number it should have, like the membrane voltage, like the combinations of ion channels it should have. And that was the major like theory that was put forward and has been like sort of the consensus for 20 years. Only there was a group at Harvard not a long time ago that they tested this. So they turned off transcription with, you can use a specific drug that is kind of specific in shutting off polymerase 2, which is the major enzyme that is responsible for transcribing DNA to RNA. So you're halting transcription over several hours. And if the theory is true that it's really calcium that is the master regulatory in controlling transcription, then you should like see a massive disturbance of trying to keep this this membrane voltage, that the cell wouldn't know how to get back to the state it was. But that's not the case. The cell has perfect, like, it. You just wash out and then the cell is back again to the membrane properties that it should have. So it seems to be the case that there's another layer on top that has nothing to do with actual transcription. And there might be like, I mean, this is super highly speculative, but one way in which RNA could like maybe control the membrane voltage in itself, or keeping it like in a balance by just having different amount of copies of these secondary structures.
I see, yeah, that's super interesting. You know, we should talk more about this, Daniel. We should do another brunch or something sometime.
Yeah. Or maybe like, I don't know if you know any physicists.
No,
that would like, because I can easily imagine how your experimenter will go after it. But what I'm afraid about is like, if you would actually run the math on it, or like a person that's really good at membrane, like physics, they would be just like, no, this is like completely meaningless. And then you spent like 3 years of like developing some like fancy genetical tools to dissect it. And it's a meaningless question.
Okay, everyone. It's 3:30, so our official room is over. So Hesam is free to go whenever he wants, but is of course welcome to stay. Now we will keep going for approximately 30 minutes more, and we will maybe keep talking about this topic, and then I'll close the room at 4 p.m. Eastern. So
I'd stay for another like 10-15 minutes.
Okay, so thank you, Hesam. So I think Ethan.
Go ahead. Yeah, it was a little, I liked the presentation. Thank you so much. But I think I need to see more diagrams in the full paper. Is there a way does anyone have a copy that they could actually send to me? Because I don't have like institutional access, and I'm a poor guy in advance.
Absolutely. I mean, I have a link that works right now. It works until mid-March. The journal like provided a link that's open access. If you click on my profile here, you can click on my Twitter account, and I have it pinned. The link is pinned.
Okay.
If you can't find, if that doesn't work for whatever reason, because I heard from one or two people that it didn't work for them, give me your email and I can just forward you the PDF.
Okay. I'm at your Twitter. Where's the free access for the 50 days? Okay, great.
Yeah.
I wish I had seen that earlier.
Yeah.
I would have been able to follow along better. All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. I apologize for that. I think the link I put in the top was open access, but maybe it wasn't. So Hyle, you had another question.
Yeah. First, about what Daniel said. From what you said, I was thinking maybe RNA can, like, the same function that neuropeptides have. Maybe you meant something like that. So maybe the same way peptides can function as kind of transferring from information between neurons, even maybe RNAs can have that function. Is that kind of related? I don't know if they exist or not. By a quick search, I couldn't find anything.
So when you're saying peptides, neuropeptides, what are you in particular thinking about?
There are some neurotransmitters between neurons, but apart from neurotransmitters that are transmitted in a standard way between within the synapses, across the synapses, using certain mechanisms that involve vesicles and stuff like that, there's also another mechanism that is exchange of some molecules, the peptide molecules, again between neurons, but sometimes they travel across the axon or even in reverse direction and stuff like that. They are kind of considered a different mode of communication between neurons, although compared to neurotransmitters. Although they can be also seen as a kind of neurotransmitters, but they're distinct. So they have similarities with neurotransmitters, but they are different. So maybe not just the contribution of RNA in charge of membrane voltage or membrane charge, but also their capacity to kind of exchange something between the neurons. Within the cells, between organelles, they probably have this function. I found something, but between neurons, I don't know. I thought it might be related to your question.
Right. Like, so narrow peptides, right, they are normally like, the idea of their action, right, is that they get in transfer over synapses or getting co-released, and usually in some systematic ways with another neurotransmitter.
Yeah.
But then, as far as I understand, isn't it like that neuropeptides, the way of action is that they bind to GPCRs in like the membrane.
Well, I think there's a matter.
And that's how they have their jargon, downstream.
Right? I mean, so neurotransmitters are neuropeptides, but I think in general, you know, in the use in biology, when, at least as I knew it, when you talked about something being neuropeptide, you're really talking about like a dipeptide or a very small, just two amino acids or three rather than a much larger neuropeptide. And those are sort of generally called neuropeptides rather than, you know, again, they're the same class as the full neurotransmitters, but neurotransmitters are just much larger neuropeptides. That's kind of always understood it. So the smaller molecules can move around in different ways.
Yeah, it's probably correct. It's just probably neuropeptides are maybe large. I don't know if they're large or small.
Yeah, I think but you they're probably
slower
word,
or maybe slightly different.
Yeah.
Quantitative difference.
Yeah, it is quantitative. I mean, I think in, you know, when someone says neuropeptide rather than neurotransmitter, they mean like basically a small neurotransmitter of one or two peptides, rather than, you know, a neurotransmitter, which would be tens and hundreds or whatever size of a molecule. But both of them are neuropeptides.
No. Neurotransmitters are usually very, very small, right? Like monoamines are small molecules compared to peptides. Like, what are the classical peptides? Is somatostatin and these kind of things. They are normally like 28 peptides. So they're fairly like big compared to serotonin, dopamine, and these kind of neurotransmitter, or even like GABA glutamate. Yeah, but it's interesting. Of course, like RNA could bind to GPCRs, but I think that would have been fairly discovered like by now if you would have these kind of things, because people have been purifying these proteins at the membrane for quite some time. And when you do these kind of assays, you would also, someone has been looking at like nucleic acids that would like follow along or binding like very effectively. So I think certain of those things probably would have been discovered. But RNAs are getting transferred across the synapse. Like Jason Shepard 2 years ago showed a quite convincing case of an immediate early gene called ARC. That's a master regulator of synaptic proteins. And that gene has been under attack from retrotransposable elements. So viruses getting attacking your genome and inserting these elements that would then code for a capsid. So it's sort of like a virus that where like the protein product of the mRNA itself coats its RNA that then acts as a vesicle transferring over the synaptic cleft. But the function of this, like even now, 2 years after the original Cell paper, is sort of like completely unknown. Like why is it getting transferred over the synapse, and what is it doing in the receiving cell?
Yeah, that sounds interesting. I have another question. If there's nothing on that topic, about the review process. Sorry.
Go ahead. Lisa,
yeah, I was going to ask about the review process because this was a paper that is kind of theoretical and not philosophical. Maybe a bit philosophical. It's kind of very theoretical and general. So what was the process of, and it's like, I think it's single author, yeah? How was the process of publishing it, and how it, was it different to kind of other more objective papers that have been, that you published before?
Yeah, so You're right. This is it's a very radical paper, and I actually, when I first wrote it, I didn't even think it could be published anywhere. But then I was lucky to just have like a lot of a lot of reception on, I don't know, social media, and like a few professors actually were ended up like turning on my side on these things. So I was super lucky with that. The review process wasn't very easy, actually. I had one desk rejection, and I didn't even, like, the desk rejection wasn't from somewhere, like a top journal. And then Journal of Theoretical Biology, they're usually mostly theory stuff, but I guess they might have been a little wary about publishing like a something that's like a, I don't know, as radical as this. But you know, the paper has simulations in it. It has a model in it, just like any other paper in Journal of Theoretical Biology would. And it has like a, you know, a mathematical proof of a system that's, you know, hasn't existed before, in the appendix. So it's like it's rigorous, but you're right, because it kind of questions a lot of the paradigms that we currently have. I guess it wasn't super easy. It took about, I mean, I wrote the bioarchive version. I put the bioarchive version. Oh, sorry, not bioarchive. Bioarchive also, by the way, wouldn't let me put it on their website, so I had to do it on archive. The archive version was uploaded back in November 2020, and it just got published like a month ago.
And I think it's a really fascinating idea, and it strikes me that it's a little bit similar to what Penrose did, but much more sane. You know, like Penrose kind of floated this quantum thing and said, somewhere in the cell we'll find a, you know, some version of entanglement or, you know, superposition that's maintained in some meaningful way, and that'll be a really great thing. And then kind of, but that was far more hand waving than what, you know, you're doing here. I think you're this kind of new computational Turing mechanism actually has extreme, you know, likelihood to be plausible considering what's actually in the cell, right? I mean, I think, you know, showing this RNA and DNA and proteins, it's, you know, the idea to go looking for it is far more reasonable than to go looking for, I think, like some quantum effects the way Penrose did when he said, well, maybe there's some quantum computing going on.
Cool, I
don't know if you see that analogy.
Yeah, yes, although I guess Penrose was trying to, like, I don't know, explain something deep about consciousness or something, like something special about what's happening inside neurons, I guess.
Yeah, no, but I think he was making the same argument. He's saying there's this ability to compute by living cells, and it's probably, if we can find some non-trivial quantum effects, then this is going to be like a great place to look. But within the ideas of biology, it's kind of extra weird, whereas what you're saying, you know, it fits, you know, there is DNA, there is RNA, there are protein sequences, they do carry information, and this kind of mechanism is, I mean, it would seem more reasonable. And so that gives me a follow-up question is, because there's places, reasonable and powerful places to look, do you have any kind of program or other people you're working with that are going to try to have techniques to maybe find, you know, this particular RNA, or maybe it's DNA, or maybe it's a protein that would, and how would you go about, like, figuring out where to look, or, you know, how do you organize your search party?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a great question. It's something I've been thinking about and talking about with people over the past couple of years. So just a quick comment on what you said. Yeah, so I guess the thing I'm clinging to is something we've known a really long time, from the 1930s. And that's what universal computation is, and the definition of universal computation. It's it's not that crazy of an idea to just like think maybe universal computation is happening, but I guess I don't know why people haven't done it yet. But as in terms of trying to discover it or find where it's happening, there are many different routes one can take. Daniel here is actually one of the people I've been talking about, and he has some ideas about how to approach that kind of question. I think the easiest path forward is through doing sequencing analysis. So we have a ton of different RNA data sets, transcriptomic data sets that sequence the RNA content within within cells. But the way that these are analyzed, usually they throw out very aberrant reads, strands that just, like, I don't know, appear once and you don't get the another strand that matches that strand. And if the way you're thinking about RNA is that these are just templates that are written off of DNA, then if you get an aberrant read, you think, okay, it's probably just noise, what role is it having, and why would it, like, how could it be generated in a consistent manner? But if you're looking for aberrant reads, maybe you can come up with analysis methods that actually reveal editing rules that can explain those aberrant reads. I think that's the most likely path forward, and that is a research direction that I want to pursue in the future.
Hey, good afternoon. If I could jump in, if I may. I was recently listening to an interview with Gary Nolan. He's a Stanford Medical School professor and a microbiology expert. And he believes that the universe is computational and that the biological processes are as well. And he specifically said that, you know, DNA is both information and a computer. If we define computer as, you know, a way of storing and processing data in a logical fashion, I think that case could be made for DNA. I'm less familiar with RNA, of course. You know, as the pandemic has persisted, I've learned a little bit about it. But I was wondering if you would agree with that, Hassan, that as it relates to RNA. And I guess I'll stop there and just leave that question.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. In principle, it can be, but you have to show how it is a computer. You have to show through what mechanism is it computing, and that, I guess, is the question that I'm interested in looking into empirically and through finding out the details experimentally. Right now, the way that we understand DNA to work in biology, I don't think with our current paradigm we can call DNA a computer, because DNA is just a template for proteins. The sequence of nucleic acids just determines a sequence of amino acids, and that's a very straightforward mapping. It's a stretch to kind of call that a computer, but I think it's reasonable to consider the idea that maybe it does underlie a computation system. But then you have to show it, because not going to convince anyone just to say that it might be.
Great. Yeah, I mean, I think the protein synthesis could be said to be more of the computer then, because that's if we go back to the definition of a computer, it's not just storing but processing. And it seems like the processing happens maybe at the protein synthesis level.
Yes.
I think you're probably on the same page as Nolan in general. I did want to follow up, because you seem to suggest that Penrose was maybe a little off and thinking there are quantum effects in biology. And I was just...
No, that was me.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I think it's pretty well established, like, quantum tunneling happens in just routine cell
function. Yeah, that's why I originally said non-trivial. Yeah. Like, obviously, like, every molecule that's in a bond is exhibiting quantum effects, right? I mean, all chemistry is quantum, so... But I mean more like that there's some... So when I say non-trivial, that's a shorthand for saying that there's some, like, superposition being maintained in some molecule, or some entanglement that's being maintained and insulated, so that it's actually could perhaps be used in some way, like what they're trying to do with quantum computing. So that's what I was saying. And I think that's far less plausible and more hand waving by Penrose.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah, in other words, is there a model that would require you to include quantum effects to understand cognition, or can you just, you know, can you just average it out and just treat it as some underlying thing in under the hood? Yeah. That you don't really need to know exactly.
And the value is there is, like, you know, the obvious notion that, you know, if there is some quantum kind of computing, well, you get such a huge leap in abilities and powers that it's, you can then say, well, that's, you know, even if you can kind of just shove everything in there and say further research, right? It's such a great box to open, but I don't know that the box is there.
Yeah.
I mean, the box is there when they actually try to make quantum computers, so that's more certain, right? It's like, well, if we can create these effects artificially and do qubits, then, well, that's the whole reason. It's that it has this incredible ability to compute in ways that classical wouldn't. So, but to then shove it into a cell is a different story.
Yeah, and I also believe that Penrose claimed, in fact, the opposite. He claimed that computation was not enough to explain cognition, that you needed some extra quantum right. stuff. So
you couldn't do it. You couldn't have it classically. And I think that's a claim all in of itself, right?
Exactly. That's what Penrose said. And in fact, I never believed it. Actually, I think, if anything, what we've shown here from Hessam's work is that is perfectly plausible to obtain some of the core biological functions by just classical computation.
I wanted to ask another question related to neuroscience and quantum effects. I don't think classical models can explain very foundational elements of consciousness, especially memory. And please, disabuse me if I'm not up on the latest and greatest research. But last I checked, there's no paradigm in neuroscience that would explain like where individual bits of memory data are stored in the brain, which to me suggests some sort of quantum effect would be the more likely theory as to how it's being quote unquote stored. But any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would agree with the part that we don't have a good theory for memory. And I have to add that this is not something that most neuroscientists would agree with. I actually don't know. Well, I don't have that. I haven't seen a survey, but most neuroscientists would say, oh, well, you don't really need any concept like bits and it's all synaptic plasticity, and you can explain it with things like synaptic plasticity and the things we know. I don't think that's, I don't find that convincing. I think we do need an explanation, but I don't think that we need quantum mechanics to get there. I think it's possible to get there with principles that we already know, especially about principles of computation that have been neglected over so many decades.
What's the most intriguing like classical theory for memory storage, even if the data hasn't been fleshed out?
There is definitely memory in neurons for certain types of stuff. It's more of the fast, some idea of a faster memory and faster processing for a higher order nervous system. But I mean, there's definitely memory in like simple neural network cells in real organisms, and that's been demonstrated. And there's mechanisms for strengthening the membranes to create those memories. Like, again, I've brought this up even just yesterday when Abyss was in the room, when the C. elegans with Kandel showed memory. So I mean, in that respect, it's definitely wrong to say that there's not memory demonstrated in living organisms, in their cells and their connections. But yeah, it's a different
when people use memory, they sometimes mean different things. And so those critics of the current paradigm of synaptic plasticity underlying memory, what they mean by memory is, they list a number of properties or features that synaptic plasticity doesn't really fulfill. So for example, if synaptic plasticity, well, we know synaptic plasticity is happening, but if it's not sitting at the top of the hierarchy for persistence of memory, maybe there's something inside the cell, maybe there's some genetic pathway that's regulating the weight of that synapse that adjusts it to a certain target, and that target is encoded genetically or encoded through some molecular mechanism. Then they say, okay, well, here the memory is not the synapse, it's that the intracellular thing. So that's where the debate happens.
And I think there's to what you were doing, Hassam, and what I think people are kind of also looking for is also a memory that has maybe in a biological sense the same type of, and I don't think there's people use this word enough, is the fidelity of the replication and the copy of the information. Like the computer, as they're talking, and I don't go into a separate thing, but you know, the computer Turing machine, you want to have a certain amount of high fidelity in the storage of the information that's going to be processed, right? But you can have memories that have that are processing lower fidelity stuff, which is an interesting question. But
I really love that thing about types of memory, right? Because there's memory that's very simple, like a memory foam pillow remembers the shape of your head when your head's not there. But then what about the type of memory of remembering your mom's name or something more linguistic based? So I think we do have to parse out what we mean by memory for sure.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very good point. I have to go within the next couple of minutes. I really, really enjoyed this, and it was very thought-provoking, and all the discussions and questions and answers from people were fun.
And I also like
Hassam. Thank you, Hassam, for coming.
If we find the kind of mechanism too, Hassam, I think it's interesting because based on the kinds of molecules and the way they behave, if this system works, you could actually have both a high fidelity memory with the processing, like a Turing machine, kind of like you're talking about, but it could also, you know, if it was just a slightly different set of molecules, they could, you know, there could be some sloppiness in the bits that just got processed under, you know, the rules of natural selection. They failed, but some of them failed the right way somehow. So I could see that you could have multiple copies of slightly different machines that do this. And so you would
Thanks a lot, Hassam, for fielding these questions.
Sure thing. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yes. So thank you, everyone, for coming. And thank you especially to you, Hassam, for explaining us this very, very interesting paper. I think especially interesting in a lot of different areas, computation, biology, and even also chemistry. So I also have to go. So I'll be closing the room at exactly 4 p.m. Eastern. So thank you everyone for coming and for asking questions. And have everyone an excellent day.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you for having me. Take care.
Take care, everyone.